apologize for a bit of delay. We had a little bit of technical difficulty. And I believe we have Dr. Ulrich on our conference line. And we're afraid we may have lost Representative Lambeth, and we're going to try to see if we can reconnect. But I think in the interest of time, we will go ahead and proceed. I'd like to welcome the council members and staff and visitors to the Acute Care Services Committee meeting. I would like to remind you, this is a business meeting that is open to the public, but it is not a public hearing. So our discussion will basically be limited to the Acute Care Services Committee members and staff, unless we have a question that we specifically want to direct to someone in the audience. The focus of this agenda, and this is our first Acute Care Committee meeting this year, so as is customary for this meeting, as we begin working on the proposed 2016 State Medical Facilities Plan, we will focus our discussion today on methodologies, and where we review policies and methodologies and determine whether there are changes that might be needed. And then based on our discussions today, staff will prepare initial drafts of the need projections for review at our next meeting, which is on Tuesday, May 5th at 10 o'clock here in this conference room. So I'd like to take a few minutes and ask the members of the committee to briefly introduce yourselves so the public will know who you are. I am Sandra Green. I am an at-large member. I am on the faculty at UNC Chapel Hill. I'm the interim chair of the Department of Health Policy and Management. And Steve, I'm going to let you go.
I'm Steve Lawler with Vidant Health. I'm an at-large member and represent the hospital industry.
I'm Dr. Mark Ellis. I'm an anesthesiologist in Charlotte and Concord, North Carolina.
Christina Apperson, an attorney and at-large member.
And do we have any other members on the phone? No. Okay. And Dr. Ulrich, are you still on with us?
I'm still here, Sandra.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. I'd like to next introduce staff. Amy, I'll let you introduce.
Amy Craddock, planner.
Okay.
Tom Dixon, database manager.
Martha Frazzoni, certificate of need.
Shelby Carroll,
Bethany Bergen, attorney general's office. Jill Bryan, attorney general's office.
Lisa Pittman, certificate of need.
Paige Bennett, planner.
Rachel Pratt for the division office.
I'm T.J. Pulliam. I'm actually a member of the SHIC, chair of long-term behavioral health, and here ex officio today to be silent.
No, you're not to be silent. So I appreciate T.J., both T.J. and Chris being here today. And we welcome your input at any point in time. Thank you for being here. So before we conduct any business, let's review our executive order number 46. Which was issued on March 4th, 2014. These are certain procedures we observe before we take any action at either the SHIC or at this subcommittee. I remind all members that it's your duty to always act in the best interest of the public without regard to your professional, institutional, or financial interests. You should recuse yourself from voting on any matter on which you cannot meet this standard. Members of the SHIC are expected to and should confer with DHHS on any matters that come before them in the developments of the plan. No member of the SHIC, however, may confer with any employee regarding any proposed provision of the plan or any proposed or pending certificate of need application in which the member has a direct, conflicting professional, institutional, or financial interest, except in public meetings conducted by DHHS or the SHIC. The ethical standards for the SHIC require that each member disclose any professional or institutional interest he or she may have in any matter coming before this committee for action. The chair will determine if the member needs to remove himself or herself from voting on the matter. The ethical standards also require each member to disclose any financial benefit he or she may derive from any matter coming before this committee. In the event of such a financial benefit, the member shall recuse himself or herself from voting on the matter. The term financial benefit is defined in Executive Order Number 46. All of the members have completed disclosure sheets describing various interests and associations that they feel should be disclosed. These sheets are available for review by the public. I'll now pause for a moment to allow members to review the matters on the agenda to make these determinations. Are there any members of the Acute Care Services Committee who desire to recuse themselves from voting on any matter on the agenda today? Okay, hearing none. Let's see. If during the course of the meeting any other issue comes up and you determine that you should recuse yourself, please let me know. Let's see. Now, moving on to the agenda, approval, we need to approve the minutes for our last meeting, which was held on September 17th, 2014. Has everyone had the opportunity to review the minutes?
I'll make a motion to approve.
A motion to approve, is there a second?
I'll second.
Any discussion, any changes, additions, or deletions? If not, all those in favor of approval, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. We have approved our minutes. Okay, so as you know, we are responsible for chapters 5, 6, and 7, and 8 in the state medical facilities plan. And so we're going to start with chapter 5 with the acute care hospital bed section. We will begin with a review of the policies and methodologies. And I'm going to ask Amy to review these for us. And I will remind you that we have not received any petitions related to this particular chapter. Amy.
Good morning, everybody. Before going into the policies specifically related to Chapter 5, I would like to draw your attention to the GEN policies in Chapter 4 of the plan. These policies are those that apply to all health services. They begin on page 35, if you happen to have the plan in front of you. Gen 1 covers reallocation of need determinations. Gen 2 covers changes in need determinations. The need determinations are revised continuously throughout the calendar year to reflect any changes in inventories. Gen 3 covers the requirement for CON applications to reflect the basic principles of quality, access, and value as described in the SMFP. Gen 4 covers the requirement for CON applications greater than $2 million to include provisions for energy efficiency and sustainability. So now, on to the policies that are relevant to Chapter 5. These are acute care policies. They begin on page 21 of the plan. Policy AC1 says that the license capacity of each hospital is used for planning purposes. The number of licensed beds is determined by Division of Health Services regulation in accordance with the licensure rules for hospitals, and the hospital must notify DHSR if any beds are converted to any other use. Policy AC3, there is no policy AC2. Policy AC3 is the exemption from plan provisions for certain academic medical teaching center hospitals. Those are facilities that are the primary teaching site for a school of medicine and at least one other health professional school. They house extensive basic medical science and clinical research programs, patients, and equipment, and they serve the treatment needs of patients from a broad geographical area through multiple medical specialties. Under policy AC3, projects proposed by the teaching hospitals that were designated as such before January 1 of 1990 are exempt from need determinations if they meet at least one of four unique academic medical needs. Number one is that the project is necessary to complement a specified expansion of the number and types of students, residents, or faculty as part of an expansion of a program within the school, or that equipment, the second one is that equipment is necessary to accommodate recruitment or retention of faculty. The third is that a project is necessary to accommodate patients, staff, or equipment to expand research activities. And the fourth criteria for exemption from need determinations is that the project is necessary to accommodate a change in the requirements of specialty education accrediting bodies. A hospital must show that the project cannot be accomplished at a non-academic medical teaching hospital and that no hospital within 20 miles has the service or equipment or whatever is being sought in the CON. This policy also has requirements for reporting and relinquishment of a CON if the assets are no longer being used for academic purposes. Policy AC4, I'm on page 23 now. I don't see too many people with the plan in front of them. Reconversion to acute care is covered under policy AC4. Facilities that have distributed beds from acute care beds to psychiatric rehabilitation, nursing care, or long-term care shall obtain a CON to convert these beds back to acute care beds. Hospitals that reconvert these beds must demonstrate that average annual utilization, days of care, is greater than or equal to the target occupancies that are laid out in this policy. The reconversions are not evaluated, however, based on the need determinations in Chapter 5. And the final policy, acute care policy relevant to Chapter 5, is the replacement of acute care bed capacity. Proposals to totally or partially replace acute care beds must be evaluated against the utilization of the total number of acute care bed days in the hospital in relation to the targets set out in the table in this policy on page 24. Critical access hospitals must include acute and swing bed days of care in utilization if they want to retain that critical access hospital designation. Regardless, hospitals must clearly demonstrate the need to maintain the bed capacity proposed in the application. There is one final acute care policy that's relevant to a later chapter, and that's when I'll discuss it.
Dr. Craddock, can you share which AMCs are covered under the AC3 rule currently?
Yes, I can. You're talking about the academic medical teachers. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That would be North Carolina Baptist, Duke University Health System, UNC Hospitals, and Vidant Medical Center in Greenville. This one is Carolina's Medical Center became an academic medical teaching center or hospital, medical center teaching hospital, after January 1st of 1990. So it's different than the others. And going on to the methodology,
okay.
Are we?
Okay, so you want to go on to the, do we need to have a motion?
My understanding from what I was told was that the vote on the policies and methodologies came at the end.
Okay, that's electrical.
Yeah, okay. So now the methodologies for Chapter 5. For those of you that have been here before, we're doing something a little bit different this year. Rather than just reading the policies, we'll try to present them in a way that might be a little more informative. You see the big screen up here. If it's is it okay to kind of turn around and look at it, or do we need to move people around? The assumptions of the Chapter 5 methodology are three. The target occupancies of hospital beds should encourage efficiency of operation of the hospitals, and these targets vary by hospital size. Larger hospitals can achieve higher efficiencies. The second assumption of this methodology is that only acute care bed days of care are used to determine utilization rates and average daily census. The third assumption is that if a hospital has been approved to change acute care bed capacity, this change is incorporated into the bed capacity used in the plan, regardless of the licensure status of the beds. The first thing that happens in this methodology is to delineate the bed service areas. These are, most of the time it's an individual county, but there are some multi-county bed service areas. These are reviewed every 3 years. It was last done in 2014, so I'm not going to go into lots of detail about how this is done. If there's one licensed acute care hospital in a county, then that's a single county bed service area. If there is not, then it would be a multi-county bed service area in which a group of counties consists of a hospital with one facility and one or more counties with no license facilities.
Can I just add the way that is done is based on data showing where people go to the hospital. So counties are grouped mm-hmm. based around where people tend to live and then where they go to be hospitalized. So the last time we made changes to this in 2014, we look at the data every 3 years, and the last time there were some changes because there are some slowly over time there's some changes in the migration from where people live to where people go to be hospitalized.
Yeah, here we see an example of that where there's a small county with no facility and several surrounding counties, and since this one county called Lamar has, these are not real counties in North Carolina, incidentally, they are real, but not in North Carolina. They have 42% of Red River County's patients. They define the Lamar Red River bed service area. Now, if more than one county has 35% of Red River's patients, the calculations get a bit more complicated. But this is the basics of how that bed service area is determined. Now, we move to the numbers. There are several types of data here. In blue, we see counts of beds that are licensed beds as well as beds for which a CON has been issued or a prior need determination exists, and days of care that we get from Truven. There's also information that's in the green cells, the very, very pale green cells, the green cell in the middle, the county growth rate multiplier that's based on population in the service area. And the yellowish color is projections of days of care, census, and occupancy into the future, 3 years into the future, based on the current counts and the population growth. Everything there is, pretty straightforward, except for probably the county growth rate multiplier. That is a calculation that's done based on the last 5 years of population data. I'm using the 2015 plan as an example. So we would start back with 2009 and get the growth rate for the past 4 years. We would get the percentage change in that growth rate each year, the negative 0.3 up. This county dropped population a little bit from 2009 to 2010. It went up, it went down, it went up. And then we average those over those 4 years to get the growth rate multiplier. As you see, that is 0.035. If the average change is greater than zero, we add one to that growth rate multiplier. So that's how we get that. These calculations aren't shown in Chapter 5 in this kind of detail, but that's how that happens. And here we see the calculations for the projections based on that county growth rate multiplier. Here we took the growth rate multiplier, column F and column G, to get the 2017 estimated days of care. Now, if that growth rate multiplier is negative, if there has been a decrease in population, we don't decrease the estimated days of care, we just use the 2013 days of care that were reported. So if that population had gone down, you would have seen 4106 in column H. Then the projected average daily census for 2017 would be column H divided by 365. If it was a leap year, we would divide it by 366. And then the beds that would be needed in 2017 is column I times the target occupancy factor. And that little table that just popped up shows the target occupancy factors, and those are based on the average daily census projected average daily census for a hospital of that size. I mean, this this hospital has a projected average daily census of less than 100. It's 12, so we would multiply 12 times 1.5 to get the value in column J. Then, to calculate the deficit or the surplus, we take column J, subtract column D, and subtract column E. And if that is negative, it is a surplus. If it is a positive number, it is a deficit. That's the way that math works in this chapter. And so this one, as you see, is a surplus and has no need.
I just want to clarify, the growth rate is not a population growth rate, it's a days of care growth rate.
That is correct. It is days of care, yes.
I'm so sorry.
That's all right.
I'm so sorry. I had that written down, and it's a different population to me. Okay. I think I'm not going to go through that in detail. To calculate the need, we determine the deficit and the surplus. And to calculate the need, we first need to ask whether any facility in a service area has a deficit, because a need is not determined for an individual facility. A need determination in the plan isn't determined for an individual facility, it's determined for the service area. If no facility in a service area has a deficit, then that's easy. There's no need in the service area at all. Then we ask whether any facility in the service area or any group of hospitals under common ownership that has a deficit, is that deficit at least 10% of their total beds or a deficit of at least 20 beds? That's the threshold. If that threshold isn't reached, then that's a need determination of zero. But if either of those things is true, if the 10% threshold is reached or the 20 bed threshold is reached, then a need determination is calculated for the service area. The number of acute care beds needed in the service area is calculated by summing all of the deficits of all the facilities and owners of hospitals in that service area. So that is my attempt to explain the methodology in Chapter 5.
Question. First of all, I appreciate putting this into layman's terms. I grew up in Eastern North Carolina and went to Pitt County Schools, so the simpler the better. And I understand the calculus. I think one of our challenges may be going forward, and I'd be interested in understanding and knowing, whether or not Health and Human Services and CMS have provided, any data or information based on, policies and guidelines that are created under the ACA, and whether or not that provides, some kind of window for us to look through in regards to if the ACA does all that it's expected to, it will, change and bend the cost curve for healthcare, but it'll also change utilization. So, it may be helpful as part of our body of work, as we talk to our friends in D.C., to have an understanding, based on where they think, the ACA is going to impact utilization, bed days, tests per thousand, and incorporate that into, some of our analysis and thinking. And if they haven't provided it, it's probably worth the ask. And if we get some forecasts from them, it's probably worth, spending some time just thinking about what those things mean. But the, the calculus and the math to date, the methodology, I think is really solid.
I think you make an excellent point. And I think though for us to look to Washington for that kind of guidance is we're probably
maybe wishful
be
thinking,
wanting.
Yeah.
I think we're going to see it more here. I mean, it's state by state is going to see it. I think, and it depends on it also the impact on the utilization of healthcare services also is dependent on whether we've expanded Medicaid, which we have not done. I think we've just been looking at the 2013 and early 2014 hospital utilization data. I think it's at the Shep Center. I think it's going to be another year before we really see the impact on the hospital utilization from the Affordable Care Act in terms of the sign-ups we've had in the state. The data I've been looking at most recently, we're not seeing much of an increase. But we do know historically that people who are uninsured use hospital services at a much lower rate than people who are insured.
Sure.
So as more of those people come under the umbrella of health insurance, I would expect to see some hospital utilization increase. We're not seeing it yet. But I think we will, here in North Carolina, we can start monitoring it and seeing it without relying on,
right,
hopefully, God. You know,
I think as we have that experience and we become more mature,
yes,
you know, with a larger population, you know, what we'll see is we'll see the trend up, yeah, and then the trend back down based,
yes,
on what goes on with payment.
Yes.
A comment I would make, a couple. Mark Twain said, if you want a friend in D.C., get a dog. And my son lives up there, and it's very true. But the other thing is...
Does he have a dog?
He does. He does. Werner the Weimaraner. Yeah. So, you know, your point is well taken in terms of trying to absorb what's happening on the national level. But having served on this council for about a decade or so, we always, always, always have to look at everything we're doing through the lenses of North Carolina.
Right.
We have to consider the greater scheme, but always focus ourselves through the North Carolina lens.
I agree completely with that. I think any additional source of information to be able to, you know, do that good work, though, is always important.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, you pointed out that this methodology is not based on population growth. It is based on historical utilization patterns, projecting them forward. And I think that is important, because just knowing the number of population is not very telling in terms of utilization and demand for healthcare services, in particular for hospital services. So anyway, I thank you, Amy, for going through
yep,
that process. Are there questions about the acute care methodology, care bed methodology? We have made, you know, tweaks over the years, but I guess our last changes were made a few years ago, but I think overall has served us well.
And do you need a motion to accept those as presented?
I need a motion to accept the policies in Chapter 5 as well as the methodologies, to use them moving forward for the next plan. Do I have a motion to that?
So moved.
Do I have a second?
Second.
All right. Is there any more discussion or conversation about this?
Just to reopen the conversation, I guess very briefly, I guess I would like to echo what Mr. Lawler said earlier today, and understanding that we are working in an environment that is changing so rapidly. Certainly as ACA, I think we will continue to have it and a responsibility and an obligation to make sure that while we are paying very close attention to the business of healthcare in North Carolina, but we're also looking outward to ensure that we are taking in all the available information to ensure that we're positioning ourselves in a forward-thinking and outward-looking way as well.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree. Any other comments or questions? All those in favor of approving the policies and methodologies for Chapter 5, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. Thank you. All right. So now we'll move on to Chapter 6. We're going to review the policies first and the need methodologies. And as you know, we have two petitions that we'll receive for this chapter, so then we will go through these two petitions individually and have time for discussion as well. So, Amy, I'll let you go through the policies.
Okay. Going through the policies is easy. There are no policies. There are no policies relevant to Chapter 6.
Sorry, you're right.
So now with the methodology, there is of course math involved. There's also a delineation of service areas for operating rooms. The process is virtually identical to the process done in Chapter 5, so I won't go through that again. However, it is important for me to note that the specific service areas in Chapter 5 and 6 may not be the same as each other, because one is based on acute care beds, the location of acute care beds and that utilization, and one is based on operating rooms and that utilization, so that may be different. For example, you may have a county with an ambulatory surgery center that does not have an acute care hospital. So that's the way that goes. We start, as usual in the methodology, with the inventory, which is in Table 6A in the plan. We do get information on the number of cases in operating rooms, in hospitals, inpatient and outpatient, and in ambulatory surgery centers. We get information on the number of operating rooms. We get information on the ORs that are excluded from the methodology, and that's kind of dark, oh dear. Dedicated C-section rooms are excluded. As you see, there's a minus one down there in the total. And if the hospital is a level one or level two trauma unit hospital, an operating room is excluded. There also are adjustments that may need to be made based on certificates of need. So we end up with the total number of rooms in the planning inventory. And that's the basis on which we calculate need determinations. So now we move on to Table 6B, where the calculations take place. Table 6B has a lot of columns, so I can't put everything on one screen. In step two of the methodology, we calculate the estimated inpatient and outpatient surgery hours based on standard case times of 3 hours for inpatient and 1.5 hours for outpatient. And this is based on the number of cases reported to us in the service area. And then we get a total. In retrospect, maybe I shouldn't have used this one as an example, because you see 3270 plus 4469 doesn't sound like it would add up to 7738, but given the way the point at which the rounding is done, that that can happen. The rounding is done before the final step, so that can yield a total number of hours that may be one number off from how the individual numbers may add up. So that gets us the total hours estimated that these cases would take. Then we go on to project future operating room requirements based on growth and here, this 0.17 is a population change rate, and it's calculated in a much simpler way than the bed days calculation is done in Chapter 5. We take the target year population minus the year that we have data for and divide that by the population for the data year. So 2017 estimated population minus 2013 divided by 2013, and we get this number up there. And we put that number, we express that number as a percent, and so the calculated number was 0.0017, so that is 17%. So this area grew some, but not a lot. So the next thing we do is take the 7,738 hours from column H, which was on the previous slide, and multiply it by the number in column I, the 0.17%. And since that is a positive, we add the 1 to it, so we increase it by 17% to obtain a number. Of surgical hours projected, the number of surgical hours projected for 2017, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought there for a second, which we estimate to be 7751.51. We assume that, we project that hospitals will be open 9 hours a day for 260 days a year and have 80% utilization. So we estimate that there will be 1,872 hours of surgery happening per operating room. We multiply, we divide column J by column J divided by column K gets us the projected operating rooms needed in 2017. So that would be 7751 divided by 7751.51 divided by 1872. So that gets us 4.14 operating rooms needed. Now, if the service area has a reduction in population, as with the methodology in Chapter 5, we assume that things are going to not change from the base year, so we don't decrease the number of surgery hours that would be needed. It would just be if this population had not grown in this county, would have carried over the 7,738 hours.
And Dr. Craddock, here, the 80% utilization is applied throughout the entire 9-hour day, is that correct?
It's applied to the whole. I guess is the way to say it.
Yeah. So the answer would be yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, pretty much a yes, because I think that's the way arithmetic works. Yeah, I didn't even do it that way. So we would project here that 4.14 operating rooms are needed. But what if the population decreased? I just answered that question. We carry over the hours from 2013. Now steps 4 and 5... to determine the surplus or deficit, we start with the number of ORs needed and subtract the number of ORs in the service area. That is the planning inventory from Table 6A. When we do it here, we get a negative 2.86 because in most cases, these numbers are just transferred from Table 6A unless something else was going on, and we'll talk about that in a second. So to arrive at the figure in column T, we do the calculation that you see here. And again, a surplus shows as a minus, so in this area, there is no need. But what if column T ended up being a positive number? So we've been in service area R, so we're moving to service area not R, and for some reason, they're projected to need 8.45 operating rooms in 2017. And yet they have the same inventory as another service area. And so here, our calculations would yield a need. They would yield a deficit, 1.45. How do we determine from that deficit how many ORs are needed? We use the deficit values here, and from this, because there are 6 to 10 operating rooms in this area, 7, we round up the amount of deficit if that fractional value is above 0.30 or above. We round it up. So this area would need 2 new operating rooms. Now, I had given you an example of kind of a plain vanilla area, but we also have this issue of chronically underutilized operating rooms, and that changes the calculations a little bit, changes the basis of the calculations. Actually, I think I changed the name from not R to QR. I'm so sorry. Let's assume that a service area has a total of 7 operating rooms, but, and this probably wouldn't happen, that there's a hospital that has 5 shared operating rooms, but that hospital's utilization has been between 30 and 35% for the last couple of years. So the cutoff for underutilization is 40%. So it's been under that 40% figure for the past 2 years. What do we do? We count the facility's procedures in determining need, but we subtract the operating rooms. So those procedures would still be conducted, but those operating rooms would not be counted in the inventory. So rather than having, you see the shared column there says 0. That's because there were 5 shared operating rooms in a single facility. That facility was an underutilized facility. So now that number 5 goes down to 0. So their total inventory is now 2. So there would be a need of 2 operating rooms in that area with the chronically underutilized facility. That is the basic information about the operating room methodology.
And that's a good explanation, Amy. And also, this methodology has gone through some reiterations over time and fine tuning, particularly having to do with the underutilized ORs. So I think you gave some good examples explaining that. Are there questions about the OR methodology? Comments? Shall we do a vote on this before we go into the petitions? Would that be helpful?
My guidance was that it was all done at the end.
Do it at the end. Okay. All right. So well, let's move on to petition 1. This is the one from Howard Stalling, from Hudson Atkins, Angel, and Davis. And I'm going to ask, you all have read the petition. We've had some comments to the petition. I'd like to have Amy review it and review the agency report on petition 1.
Okay. Thank you. We did receive this petition. There were no comments received on this petition. The petitioner requests that the SHIC review its methodology for calculating operating rooms needed in the state medical facilities plan and change the standard methodology used to calculate OR capacity. In addition to a general examination of the OR methodology, the petition appears to favor using 2 different need determination methodologies, one for hospital-based ORs and one for freestanding ambulatory surgery centers, but the petition doesn't give specific direction regarding what the methodology should be. The petition's first general recommendation is that there should not be acceptance of applications from new ORs from individuals who demonstrate an ownership surplus of ORs, I should say entities that demonstrate an ownership surplus of ORs. However, the designation of entities eligible to apply for certificates of need is outside the purview of the SHIC and can't be addressed in the methodology. The second focus of the petition addresses the increase in the state population and suggests that the extent of general population growth is directly related to the number of surgical patients in the population. The methodology does take into account the population increase when determining need, as I described in my presentation just a few minutes ago. The relationship, the agency's position is that the relationship between general population growth and its possible effect on the number of surgical patients is complex and multifaceted, and such an examination is outside the scope of the planning process. Finally, the petition states that the methodology, and I quote, does not consider how many of the current 262 surplus ORs are dormant or underutilized. The methodology does consider chronically underutilized facilities when determining operating room need. Again, as I noted in my presentation, the language in the petition indicated that there was concern about the 262 surplus ORs. We don't have data available on the utilization of specific ORs within a facility. We receive data about utilization for the whole facility, so we can't address anything about, or the methodology does not address anything about utilization in a specific OR, which appeared to be the request here in this petition. The petition also expresses concern regarding the retention of some of the ORs in the inventory that have an approved certificate of need but that have not yet been licensed. Under state law, certificates of need don't expire, and as such, this process is not under the purview of the SHIC and therefore can't be reflected in the methodology. Moving on to how the SHIC has addressed potential alterations in the OR methodology, Dr. Green referred to one just a few minutes ago. In 2007, the SHIC formed a work group that culminated in a couple of things. One was the inclusion in the methodology of consideration of chronically underutilized operating rooms. That was implemented beginning with the 2008 plan. The work group also recommended development of utilization assumptions based on facility-specific data. This was incorporated in the 2009 plan. In general, the need determination thresholds are more modest for smaller facilities than larger facilities. The agency recommendation. The agency recognizes that ambulatory surgery centers have characteristics that differ from hospitals, which may warrant examination. The single specialty ambulatory surgery center demonstration project, which began in 2008, examines an aspect of ambulatory surgery centers. Final results aren't yet available for this project, and in the interim, the SHIC has been hesitant to alter the operating room methodology pending final results, pending receipt of those final results. So given the available information submitted and in consideration of factors discussed above, the agency recommends denial of this petition. The agency supports the standard methodology for OR need determination. The agency, however, acknowledges that since the last OR methodology review was in 2007 and 2008, the SHIC may choose to undertake a new review. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy. So, discussion, thoughts about the petition and the agency report? Yes.
Just a couple questions, if I may. It wasn't apparent to me, or perhaps I missed this during the presentation for the last full shift, but not a central point, but I think an interesting point for this group is, who was the client that was represented in this petition? I'd just be curious to know.
Most excellent question.
I think Dr. McBride has that question, and he got an answer, but I don't recall the answer.
Okay. Yeah, I'd be curious to know.
I wondered the same thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Does anybody
if you've ever
care?
Seen the movie The Wizard of Oz, it's always important to know who's behind it.
Does anyone in the audience care to address that? Yes.
He's an ophthalmologist down in New England.
Thank you.
I guess perhaps another potentially important point in the conversation, and I don't have a predetermined outcome in asking any of these questions, of course, but has there been some legislative interest, will, concern with the methodology in general? And I'm certainly not excited about politicizing this issue by any stretch of the imagination, but we certainly don't want to let the tail wag the dog. But it would be interesting to hear or to know if there's been any criticism, where it comes from, what the real merits of those conversations are before we take action. I guess I'm asking for just an environmental standard.
There's a current bill that introduced House Bill 200 that addresses or actually talks about ambulatory surgical centers, multi-specialty, and it was originally single-specialty, and that's multi-specialty. Doesn't specifically get into the methodology of the SHIC or that, but it's involving removing those from the process, ambulatory surgical center from the process, planning process, and procedure.
Is there any prognostication on the legislative will to?
Right now, I can tell you what we're doing as far as what we've been asked to do is submit information on fiscal note as to what it would cost the division to as far as implementation of that, if the law would pass or deal with that. So that's where we are at this point. There's not been a committee meeting scheduled yet to discuss it.
Is the committee that that had all of the hearings last year, are they still active on the CON? They're not.
No, they were. They didn't take a vote at the end of the meetings, so therefore that bill basically died, and the new bill we introduced was House Bill 200.
Okay. Yes.
If I can make a comment, and I think this is totally in bounds with self-interest and recusals, and so we do have a legislator, two legislators on the SHIC, and I think it's fully in bounds for SHIC members to speak with SHIC members. Mm-hmm. And I think they, at least one that I know would be receptive to a phone call, the one that serves on this committee.
Yeah, I'm sorry he's not with us. We didn't have any luck getting catching.
No, I didn't hear back from his assistant.
We expected him to be on the phone today. Other comments, thoughts on the petition?
This may get a little towards what Mr. Lawler was speaking about, Ms. Apperson. Again, I think we always have to be aware of what's going on nationally. Mm-hmm. Again, we always have to focus on North Carolina. So North Carolina focus, quality, access, value. National focus, which is still relevant here, is right care, right place, mm-hmm. right time. Mm-hmm. If we're going to take care of this whole puzzle, quality, access, value, right care, right place, right time. I think all those principles need to be kept in mind.
So the agency recommendation is that the SHIC may choose to undertake a new review of the OR methodology. What's your reaction to that recommendation? Do you think it warrants the OR methodology, which you've just heard a review of, should be reviewed further? What's the pleasure of the group?
Because my recommendation, one, is and the review of the methodology, I think, is independent from whether or not we, you know, take action on, you know, the presentation and then the recommendation by staff. So, Madam Chairman, I would recommend we do that first and then open the door in regards to, you know, whether or not there's merit to, you know, reviewing and, you know, the methodology and having a small group do that. There's always merit in kind of looking at, you know, our body of work and making sure that, you know, we're serving the people of North Carolina. So based on your pleasure, I would like to make a motion in regards to accepting the methodology as well as accepting the recommendations by staff in regards to the petition.
Okay. Do I have a second on that motion?
Second.
Is there more discussion?
So then your recommendation then would be to accept the petition and the, can you repeat the
My recommendation is to accept the recommendation by staff, based on the review of the petition.
Which is rejection.
We need to take action on the petition. So
you approve the methodology, but you want to reject the petition.
Correct.
Got it. Okay. Right. Okay. So let's be clear. The motion is to approve our methodology as has been presented and to reject the petition.
Correct.
Right. I think Mr. Leisner makes some valid points, and I think we should always be open to, you know, times change, populations change, and if we're not open to reevaluating the methodologies, things will be missed. And I think, that having a positive attitude towards review of methodology going forward is always important.
Okay. So all those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. So approved. And would you like to take additional action to suggest a review?
I would say that you as the chair can empower a group, and I think it may just require affirmation by this group, to create a subcommittee to, you know, discuss and review the methodology.
Okay. Yeah.
Actually, if I could comment. Dr. Ulrich, speak up if you agree with this. It's up to Chairman Ulrich to put together a work group. For this committee, it's absolutely in bounds to suggest to the SHIC, and this will go to the full council meeting on Wednesday, June 3rd, to recommend consideration for creation of a work group to study the OR methodology, but also I would think broaden that perspective to also talk about these single site ORs around the state, because this has been an evolution for 6 years now.
Yeah.
It's not exactly an aggressive planning timeline. So I think that all that stuff needs to be looked at.
Okay.
And for your consideration.
Okay.
Sandra, is it my turn to talk?
Yes, it is your turn to talk.
I've thought a lot about this and agree that a review is warranted. What I'm hesitant to do is to launch a review before the legislative process is concluded.
Okay.
Because the framework of the review may change considerably depending on the action of the legislature.
Duly noted, yes.
And therefore, you could spend a lot of resources and individuals' time working on a policy which becomes moot.
Okay.
But I would certainly, I certainly favor forming a group to look at this once we know what the framework is. But I would hesitate to carry forward a motion that says we're doing it, right now.
Okay, and I don't think that was necessarily the intention, but if we did a motion to recommend to the SHIC that at the appropriate time a work group be formed.
I have no problem with that. I actually was intending to launch this sort of an effort anyway until all those flurry of bills were filed.
Yeah.
And I have no problem if that's the sentiment of the committee, but I would prefer an open-ended timetable in terms of when we act on it.
Okay. All right, thank you. All right, I'm hearing, do we want this in a motion? Is this a formal? So moved?
So moved. And okay. May I also add another point to Dr. Ulrich's, I think, very, very well-considered and well-intentioned point. I guess I'm offering a comment in the spirit of yes and.
Mm-hmm.
And if there is an opportunity, if it feels as though this legislature or this legislation is proceeding at a pace or in a direction that may not ultimately be as positive as we would like it to be, is it also possible to add into that conversation that the SHIC is very open during the course of any legislative discussions that y'all are engaged in, to say that the SHIC is actively engaged and open and interested in continuing or in beginning this work group so that they know that that this isn't a body that isn't willing to consider changes.
Point well taken. One thing I would remind all of us is we're advisory to the governor. There's a process. We are stewards of process. We're not a policy-making body. And I think we need to keep a little focus on that, even though we'd love to tell everybody what to do and think. But there is a process currently, and we have to respect the people in the process. Is that fair?
That's right. Very well stated.
All right, so I hear a motion.
So moved.
Okay, so moved. Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, so let's move on to our second petition from Knowles Smith and Associates. Would you like to review petition and the agency report?
The agency report, I will review. Petitioner requests the creation of policy OR1 to establish certain conditions that would exempt from the standard methodology operating rooms in licensed and CMS certified ambulatory surgical facilities dedicated to pediatric dental surgery, provided they meet certain criteria. The petitioner describes several medical, regulatory, financial, and geographical challenges to serving children with significant dental health needs, especially those children whose dental care is covered by Medicaid. Starting off with a medical challenge is simply that pediatric dental surgery takes substantially longer than typical ambulatory surgical procedures. The agency does collect information on the length of procedures, but we don't have information separated out by adult and pediatric cases. So the methodology as it stands can't address the reported length of time to us about pediatric dental surgery. Also, the petition points out that dentists have regulatory barriers to admitting patients to surgery in hospitals, or admitting patients for surgery in hospitals. While these regulations may cause real problems, they're outside the purview of the SHIC because they're in state regulations. The petition points out that medical and regulatory challenges can translate into financial barriers, especially for patients covered by Medicaid. Given the long average duration of pediatric dentistry surgical cases and the financially unattractive Medicaid reimbursement rates, petitions report that this may serve to limit block time for pediatric dental surgery in settings outside of the dental practice. The agency has not addressed oral or dental surgery directly, but has addressed pediatric surgery more generally in a prior work group. In 2011, the SHIC formed a pediatric OR work group charged to investigate and develop recommendations about whether the standard operating room methodology should include a determination of need for dedicated pediatric ORs. This work group did focus on hospital-based ORs. Recognizing the differences between the needs and characteristics of pediatric and adult surgery, the work group recommended that pediatric cases be weighted heavier than adult cases in determining OR need. But this recommendation wasn't approved by the committee. It was a work group recommended to this committee, and this committee did not go forward with that recommendation. And hence, the SHIC did not approve a recommendation to weight pediatric OR cases heavier than adult cases. But it did point out that hospitals are free to designate operating rooms as pediatric ORs if they feel the need to. The SHIC's recommendation was that hospitals with high pediatric OR volumes should consider submitting adjusted need petitions in the summer if they feel that additional ORs are needed to handle this large volume of pediatric cases. The the SHIC historically hasn't favored creating or changing policies or methodologies to address issues regarding a single specialty or a single type of patient, whether it be a proposed new single specialty facility, OOR is dedicated to a single specialty in an existing facility. Given the available information submitted and the comments received, and we did receive comments on this petition, and consideration of the factors discussed above, the agency recommends denial of this petition, and it supports the standard methodology for OR need determination. While the SMFP shows that the state has a sufficient number of ORs to serve pediatric dental patients, the agency recognizes that accessing surgical services can present challenges for some types of patients, some specialties, and some providers, and in some geographical areas. Since policies have a statewide impact, policies address a statewide concern or issue. And analysis of additional data would be necessary to examine whether the challenges presented in this petition exist statewide. The Acute Care Services Committee may choose to recommend a stakeholder group or some other mechanism to explore options and alternatives to address this request. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy. Let's open it up for discussion.
Well, I think this pediatric dental issue is a huge train that we're not in front of in the state. I see it personally in our locale of the state. And I'm not sure, it seems like the path of least resistance would be to grant this. That would be easy, and I think it would begin to, but I'm not sure even that would get in front of this. I think there are a lot of issues here. I mean, when I read some of the responses to the petition, it seems like most of the medical facilities are making a best effort to provide the OR time, but I sort of get two different stories on these two.
Can you expand on what you're talking about?
Well, I'm just saying if you...
Yes.
Right, I understand that. You very well, but blood doesn't pump from
but
the stomach.
I was not raised in Cook County, by the way.
Everyone can be that lucky.
I think there are two hospitals that responded. It was Cape Fear Valley and Southeastern Regional, and they seem to act as if or state that they are providing the OR time, versus the dental group seems to have an opposite opinion of that. It sounds as if they don't have the equipment available. They need a dental table. They don't need an OR table. And it presents a challenge to them. Who's right? And I do think, there is a fiduciary responsibility in these communities. If they have the certificate of need and they have the OR space, they and the physicians that are there should be making the best effort to take care of their community. Yes. And I'm not sure these letters here answer that. Yeah.
We need, as a result of this petition, and I've talked with Dr. Ulrich and actually talked with the secretary as well, we decided to do a little research, and I know that Amy kind of generalized it, but what happened is we talked to a number of these dentists from across the state to try to get a feel for how big a problem this may be, and we also talked with a number of hospitals CEOs to get their take. And I think it's the responses varied. Some of it centered around block time as opposed to OR times. And hospitals were reluctant to set aside block time because of the volume and so forth. Some of it centered around anesthesiology and the availability and that sort of thing. So there was a number of reasons why I think it's happening. I think we were a bit surprised that it kind of surfaced as quickly and we didn't realize it beforehand. But in talking with Dr. Ulrich, and he may want to chime in here, what staff was wanting to encourage, and Amy mentioned it, was that maybe we put together a work group similar to what we did with the PET stakeholder group, not particularly a work group, but a stakeholder group, come together and try to look at the problem, see how big a problem it really is, and see if there are some things that the SHIC could include as from a policy standpoint as far as trying to address some of these needs. I haven't heard anybody say that the methodology needs to change. It was basically a policy petition, and that's what we addressed. And I think that's what the discussion needs to center on.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. I think the methodology that is outlined is a reasonable methodology. I do believe that, you know, that there are issues that may be community specific or maybe multi-community specific that deal with citizenship, fiduciary responsibility, and medical staff bylaws, rules, and regulations, and how the medical staff, to include, you know, dentists, at least in our facility, that are integral parts of the medical staff, you know, how they best, you know, work together to make sure that those resources that are, you know, there to serve the people of North Carolina are best used in a way that, you know, creates the greatest value, once they're awarded, and then they become, you know, the responsibility for an institution to care for and support. So I do support, you know, the idea that, you know, the methodology is reasonable. Mm-hmm. You know, I think having a group look at, you know, what are some of the barriers either, you know, that are in some cases self-imposed by, you know, a medical staff's, you know, kind of body of work, as well as, you know, creating blocks of available time by the hospital.
I think some of these bylaws coming from an older hospital at one point, you know, were put in place in the 50s sometimes, and they have not changed. And like I say, I think they present a structural barrier to a new problem that has arisen. And you've got this very large, very poor immigrant population that did not exist 15 years ago, 20 years ago. There were no Hispanics, essentially, in North Carolina in 1990. And I think that's probably a lot of what this population is. I know that's the population in the Charlotte area. And as I said, you know, you could grant this CON, and it's not going to fix the problem. You know, I think a work group may be, you know, going forward. We're not going to fix it today, I don't think. So.
And I've had a number of people have commented to me, not necessarily in writing, but emails, phone calls. I'm convinced there is a problem. There is a problem out here. It may not be in every community. It may be in certain communities, and it's very complicated. I mean, I hear it from hospital CEOs who are complaining about these patients that end up in their emergency rooms, and they are not equipped to handle them. They can't find dentists to hire to take care of them. They're looking for other sources and other places. So I'm convinced that that there is a problem, and we need to help figure out how to move this forward in some productive way.
So I was very enlightened about 10 days ago by going to a First Health of the Carolinas Foundation event, which was co-hosted by the foundation and a local dentist, to screen a film that came out of the Cleveland Clinic called Say Ah. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, you really got to see that. Go to YouTube or whatever to see it. Say Ah. Builds a compelling case that whether you're a kid or an adolescent or a grown-up, if your teeth are in bad shape, you're at much higher risk for systemic disease, obesity, diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, straight down the line. We don't get a lot of action from dentists or dentistry here at the SHIC, but I'll tell you, that was an eye-opener, and I now floss every day. So I would commend that to everyone's review as we consider this, because we got to take care of the kids.
Right.
There ain't no doubt.
Well, I'm hearing it's not just the kids. It is a problem of access for all dental patients who have no insurance and no regular dentist and no, you know, no other options, but ending up in emergency departments. So it sounds like we're kind of all on the same page that what's the pleasure of the group in terms of a motion? how would we want to?
Kendra, Dr. Ulrich,
yes.
While you're considering your pleasures, could I just add a little perspective?
Absolutely.
I've had long conversations with Drexel and other folks, and he's had many around the state. And I think while the impetus is the children, you're absolutely correct, it is an adult and child access issue. It has layers that go well beyond the plan, as Dr. Lawler and others have alluded. And we don't understand all of the ramifications of how to solve the problem in the time frame of this petition. But we should be committed to finding a better solution that can be applied in every area of the state over time. And so a stakeholder group, whether it's done by the SHIC or under the Department of Health and Human Service, that has to be worked out, is a very worthy place to start rather than tinkering with the plan while not solving other barriers. And there are financial, there are staff issues. And in fact, the more you look at this, the more complicated the onion becomes. But I think we would all agree that people need this care, as TJ has alluded. And we're not doing as good a job in the state with this as we need to.
Thank you, Chris. A motion?
Yeah, I would make a motion that we table this petition.
We can't table.
Can't table.
We have to take action.
Reject.
Well, I guess we can table till we have to take action by the end of the this by September. Mm-hmm. But typically we accept or we reject, and then we can choose to do a stakeholder work.
And is it likely that we would have a stakeholder work group and any body of work done by September?
It's very unlikely.
Yeah.
It's very unlikely.
But if we table
it. Let me comment on that as well. If you table this and it doesn't go out for public discussion, and since it's a policy issue, I don't believe we can act on it at the last meeting of the year.
Okay.
So I think you have to either decide to accept or reject the petition, and then we'll commit, I've already committed basically that working with Drexel, we will develop a process to get stakeholder input to look at this. But it's already very clear there are many pieces of this puzzle that are beyond SHIC action and need others to pitch in.
Okay, thank you. A motion?
Rephrase.
Okay, rephrase.
Then I make a motion that we reject the petition and also go forth with a stakeholder group
right.
To study the issue.
Okay. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Is there further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. All right, so that completes Chapter 6. We will move to other acute care services in Chapter 7, policies and methodologies. Amy.
Thank you. Chapter 7, other acute care services, has one policy, and that is an AC, an acute care policy found in Chapter 4. It's policy AC6 pertaining to heart-lung bypass machines for emergency coverage. A need is determined for one additional heart-lung bypass machine whenever a hospital is operating an open-heart surgery program with only one heart-lung bypass machine. This is to protect cardiac surgery patients who may require emergency procedures while scheduled procedures are underway in the one existing room. A certificate of need for a machine covered under this policy is exempt from the performance standards in the North Carolina Administrative Code. That's the policy for this chapter. The methodologies in Chapter 7 cover three areas of acute care services. The first is open heart surgery services. The need determination methodology was actually eliminated beginning with the 2012 State Medical Facilities Plan. However, a certificate of need is required to obtain heart-lung bypass equipment. So that's the methodology statement for open heart surgery services. The next area covered in Chapter 7 is burn intensive care services. Burn intensive care services are defined in the statute as services provided in a unit designed to care for patients who have been severely burned. North Carolina has two burn units, one UNC Hospitals in Chapel Hill and the other at North Carolina Baptist Hospital in Winston-Salem. It has a need determination methodology that is a little bit different. Need determination is calculated only when the two existing burn units have a total average occupancy rate of 80% during the past 2 years. Table 7C in the State Medical Facilities Plan shows those figures, or you can calculate it yourself, which is the days of care divided by the number of beds times 365 days. So if that 80% threshold is reached or exceeded, then, and it, I can say it, it usually is not reached. Utilization is usually lower than that. If it is reached, we calculate the four-year average annual growth rate for burn unit days of care. This is like very similar to Chapter 5, using the five most recent years of data from Table 7C. And then we add one to the growth rate to calculate the projected days of care, and we determine the number of beds needed, such that the total utilization of existing beds minus CON approved beds, of existing and CON approved beds would be 80%, and that is the calculation of the additional beds needed there under item number 4. So that's the short and sweet need methodology for burn intensive care services. The third general area covered in Chapter 7 is transplantation services. Within this service, there are two types of transplants, bone marrow and solid organ transplants. The need determination for bone marrow transplants is based only on the number of allogenic bone marrow transplants performed. And these are performed only in academic medical center teaching hospitals. I'll get that order of words right sooner or later. The need determination does not include consideration of autologous bone marrow transplants, only allogenic. A need is determined when each of the existing services has performed at least 20 allogenic bone marrow transplants during the fiscal year just prior to the development of the current state medical facilities plan. I have no calculations for that. Solid organ transplant services is the final area of Chapter 7. These services are also limited to academic medical center teaching hospitals and the availability of solid organs. There's no mathematical calculation for need determination. The plan states that the current volumes of procedures performed in existing solid organ transplant services are not sufficient to require the development of additional solid organ transplantation services. It also is important to note that introduction of a new solid organ transplantation program in a hospital with an existing program is not considered a new health service unless it requires a capital expenditure of $2 million or more. That is the information for Chapter 7.
Okay. Any questions about those methodologies?
Motion to approve.
Second. And any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay.
I mean, these are all highly specialized.
They are.
You know, programs, and we're fortunate to have good programs in the state. Mm-hmm.
So our last chapter is 8, inpatient rehab.
There are no policies associated with Chapter 8, and the methodology is also pretty simple and straightforward and similar to what I just presented. Except for inpatient rehabilitation beds, we calculate a 3-year average annual rate of change for inpatient rehabilitation days of care. Some of the others, it was a 4-year. This is a 3-year. And we determine the number of beds needed such that total utilization would be 80%. And there you see the calculations for how we determine the projected days of care. And then once we get that projected days of care, how we calculate the additional beds needed. So that is the methodology for inpatient rehabilitation services.
Okay, any questions on that one? Do I have a motion to approve the use of these going forward?
So moved.
Second.
Second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay. All right. Is there any other business we need to address? Drexel, anything? Amy?
Not that I am aware of. If
right.
I'm looking to other people.
Okay. So thank you all. And I do want to make one final comment about our petitions and our petitioners. Just because we reject petitions don't mean they're not of value. They're of great value to us. I know a number of you in the audience are the ones who've been very involved in presenting these petitions to us. And I think we're going to have 2 work groups come out of this. And these are two very important issues that need our attention. They're complex issues, and we hope you all will help be involved in helping to discuss these issues moving forward. This is a changing healthcare environment, and it's challenging, and we need to all be working hard to understand the issues and make sure our policies here are helpful and not hurtful, for making sure that all of our citizens have access to good quality care. So thank you all for today, and we will see you our next meeting on May 5th at 10 o'clock right here.
Very good.
Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anytime you can get some homework assignments out of a good committee meeting, that's a good thing.
Yep. I think that's what we just did.
Yep. Well, and those discussions, you know, will make healthcare better. A lot of these are, you know, bigger than an individual site.
Yeah, I thought I might have put it that
in
the email.
I'm going to volunteer a great chat with ECU. Has a new supplement, too. He's been the chairman of the Dental Association. Three, he's got these community-based clinics, so he'll have some unique insight and perhaps some observations.
And it was also scary to me to look at these specific policies they were proposing.
And you're right. Yeah. Some, you know, for those that are doing the petition, sometimes it's disappointing that their request wasn't honored. However, you know, it does create a framework for perhaps better decisions.
I see a lot of patients, you know, it's a lot of vascular work, a lot of fractures, a lot of medication. they fixed in today, or if they thought it would be, just, it's not a...
All right, thank you. Good job.
Thank you. Sorry, I stumbled on that population.
No, that's all right.
I had this appear
no,
written
I knew
down.
I knew you had it. I wasn't going to ask you that question.
Well, I had this appear written down.
Yeah, no, it's confusing because the author...
Good thing you started
to know this. Right. And I had been thinking much more about the author.
Right.
It's a big issue.
Likewise.
All right, so you've got what you need moving forward.
I have what I need moving forward from the chef's office. Yes. Yes. And the new way of breaking down ages, mental health has to come back to the same way to approach it. It's anything with the truth. I mean, I know it's doable, but it, unless and until they send us something from this point on.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm on call.
Because it's more trouble for
so I'm sorry.
That's ours tomorrow. is doing that. I think your time right now is putting in the population numbers in our database.
Right. Okay. Right. Patients don't need oral surgery.
And I have the treatment data ready to put in. Yeah, and as far as the next steps with the stakeholder and all that, that is part of your work.
Awesome.